This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year, Good Friday and the First Seder of Passover fall on the same day. John Dominic Crossan has been examining how the story of Jesus' trial and his crucifixion has been used to justify anti-Semitism. He questions the historical accuracy of the gospel story, which says the Jewish crowd called for Jesus to be crucified even after the Roman governor declared him innocent. Crossan says that this story took on a dangerous anti-Semitic tone after Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire in the 4th century. John Dominic Crossan is a professor of biblical studies at DePaul University in Chicago and co-founder of the Jesus Seminar. He's a former Roman Catholic priest. He last spoke to us after the publication of his earlier book about the historical Jesus. His new book is called Who Killed Jesus? Exposing the Roots of Antisemitism in the Gospel Story of the Death of Jesus.
In one sense, of course, you can never find anything in the Bible about the Jews killing Jesus. Jesus was crucified, and crucifixion was a Roman execution, and he was executed by Roman soldiers in the Roman manner of execution. But the key, if you wanted to zero in on one text more than anyone else, you'd have to go to Matthew's Gospel, where Pilate is insisting that this man is innocent. And the crowd, and this is only in Matthew's Gospel, the crowd says, his blood be upon us and upon our children, which means we take responsibility for this execution. We consider it right to do it. We take responsibility. Then in Matthew's Gospel, Pilate washes his hands. So in effect, the responsibility is transferred from the Roman governor, who's going to conduct it, of course, to the Jerusalem crowd who have said, his blood be upon us and upon our children. That is the lethal heart of the problem.
Do you think that the story that a Jewish crowd insisted on Jesus' execution, do you think that story is based in fact?
That a Jewish crowd called for Jesus' execution while a Roman governor insisted he was innocent, I would call pure fiction. Let me tell you how I can say that. Obviously, you can't prove a negative. You can't prove something didn't happen. And in any historical reconstruction, you never have absolute certitude. You have to make your best reconstruction. When I look at that scene, and I look at Pilate, for example, we happen to know a lot about Pilate from outside the Gospels. There's a lot of governors in the first century, and we don't know a thing about them beyond their name. But Josephus, again, in the second half of the first century, tells us quite a lot about Pilate, and the Jewish philosopher Philo in the first half of the first century tells us about Pilate. Philo, for example, says, he uses him as an example of a bad governor almost, he says he put many people to death without trial. Now, what does Josephus tell us? Two major items. He tells us that he had a rather nasty form of crowd control, that very often when people, unarmed protesters, came up to appeal for something, for example, something that he had done, like taking the images of Caesar into the sacred precincts of Jerusalem. When the unarmed crowd came up to protest, he simply surrounded them by his soldiers and ordered the soldiers to attack. This is the Pilate now who meets with the crowd in the gospel and backs down. This same Pilate is also told by Josephus to have been extremely insensitive, let me put it mildly, to Jewish religious beliefs and sensitivities. So when I look at Pilate as I know him from non-Christian sources, and I look at Pilate as I know him from the gospel sources, my final conclusion is no, I don't think Pilate acted like this or would ever have acted like this. And so I think the crowd insisting that we are responsible and Pilate handing responsibility for the death of Jesus over to the crowd is fiction. If you wish to call it sacred fiction, by all means, it is Christian propaganda, that is one Jewish group, Christians, appealing against other Jewish groups to the Romans. Yes, in answer to your question, it is fiction.
So you find it hard to believe that this historically happened because you can't believe that someone like Pilate would defer to the crowd if he really believed in somebody's innocence.
Exactly. And that is one half the argument. The second half is that it fits so neatly into what Christianity has to do in, remember that at this stage, Christianity is a small, relatively marginalized, powerless group struggling with with other Jewish groups who probably have much more power than it has. And it is, as I said, creating propaganda, as it were.
Yeah, what do you mean by propaganda? That has such an ugly sound to it.
I don't quite know what other word to use, Terry. People have said to me, why don't I call it what it is, a lie? The reason I don't do that is in the first century, in one sense, everyone is doing this. Everyone is trying to present themselves in their best light. Jesus was crucified by Roman power. That creates an immediate problem for his followers. Because any time that they are known, for example, as Christians, when Tacitus tries to explain what's a Christian, he says it's a follower of Christ. What's a Christ? A Christ was somebody crucified by Roman authority. Then this must be a subversive group, right? This is the followers of somebody whom we executed for subversion. That's what crucifixion was. It was not just for any old crime. It was especially for subversion among the lower classes. So how do you explain that you're not a subversive group? Well, in our story, Pilate really wanted to let our Jesus off. And it was only that the crowd insisted. And so Pilate reluctantly gave in. I don't know what to call that. You could call it apologetics. That's a sort of a polite theological name that scholars use. We might call it today, to put it bluntly, spin. I call it propaganda because I think that's what it is.
How do you explain, though, to people that this story of the Jews insisting on the execution after Pilate says Jesus is innocent appears in the Gospels?
As a Christian, the Gospels are inspired. If you consider that inspiration means that God, as it were, is dictating to a secretary who is rather passive and taking it all down verbatim, then of course you could not say what I have just said. If you consider that inspiration, as I do, inspiration is an interaction between a divine and a human author, if you will, and that God has to work with the loves and hates, the prejudices and biases, the sexism and racism, to put it bluntly, of that author, then I think you can understand how in Matthew, but not in any of the other ones, because Matthew is fighting bitterly, and I think fighting a losing battle with other Jewish groups, extensive bitterness is present in Matthew, more than, say, is present in Luke.
And is Matthew the only gospel that this particular story appears in?
Yes, Matthew is the only gospel that says, his blood be upon us and upon our children, and that Pilate washes his hands. There is in a gospel outside the New Testament called the Gospel of Peter, in which the washing of the hands appears, but not that statement, his blood be upon us and upon our children. So that is only in Matthew. And let me put it this way too, Terry. If you were to take the Gospels absolutely literally so that everything that's in there had to have happened, let's say you're reading it in a very conservative way, then you should also say that before noon, the people said, his blood be upon us and upon our children, but the dying prayer of Jesus annulled that before 3 o'clock in the afternoon when Jesus prayed, his Father, forgive them for they know not what they do. So whoever the them are, they're already forgiven.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Dominic Crossan. He's the author of the new book, Who Killed Jesus? He previously was our guest on Fresh Air to talk about the historical Jesus. He's the co-founder of the Jesus Seminar and a professor of Bible studies at DePaul University. I think for so many people, religion is in part history, but it's also faith, a kind of faith that doesn't rely on a factual sense of history, but more on beliefs. What happens when the two come in conflict? I mean, have those ever come in conflict for you, your sense of what happened in history and your sense of faith?
They don't for me because, in one sense, I spent 20 years in a Roman Catholic religious order, and it was a medieval order, and the Middle Ages always insisted that reason and revelation are, in terms of what your terms, history and faith, could never contradict one another. So Thomas Aquinas never worried when he was reading the pagan philosopher Aristotle, he might find something in there that would contradict his faith. Faith for me is a fundamental interpretation of something. It is the rock bottom interpretation on which your life is based. It is never a fact. You look at Jesus and you look at Jesus crucified, and if you're a Roman soldier, you say this is the death of one more insurgent and count one for the Roman order, as it were. I would even call that Roman faith, Roman imperial faith. The Christian who looks at Jesus crucified and sees this as the salvific death of the Son of God is also making an act of faith. Neither of those acts of faith can be proved, but they are looking and interpreting an historical fact. Jesus existed. Jesus died, for example. But faith is an interpretation. It is, by that definition, beyond proof or disproof, unless, of course, you are silly enough to get faith mixed up with history and think it's based on some historical fact rather than an interpretation of a fact.
You make the point in your book that many Christians today don't take the story of Genesis as literal historical truth, that it's possible to be a Christian and believe in the scientific theory of creation and to read the Genesis story as a parable, as something that's supposed to tell us something about God, but not the scientific way that everything was created. But you say that, that ability to distinguish between parable and scientific truth or history, the ability to do that diminishes for a lot of people as you get closer to the story of Jesus's crucifixion and then resurrection.
Yes, it's almost as if there was a quarantine, a safety zone around the beginning of Jesus's life and the end of Jesus's life, which many Christians would not put, many at least liberal Christians, would not put around the beginning and end of the world, as it were. And it seems to me you have to have a consistent way of reading the Bible. You can't announce principles that there is inspired fiction in the Bible, which I think is true. And I see no reason why God would want to inspire only information or fact. Why couldn't God want to inspire fiction? The parables of Jesus, after all, are all fiction. That doesn't mean they're false. That may mean they never happened, if you want to put it that way. The stories, in other words, story of the Good Samaritan does not depend for its truth on whether a man was ever beaten up on the road between Jerusalem and Jericho. A parable is something which is truer than fact. Maybe that's the best way to put it. And once you begin to realize that, then many of the parables in the Bible and many of the stories, I think, in the New Testament, in the Gospels, are best described as parables. They may be based on history in the sense, of course, that Jesus did exist, but they're parables. That's the proper title for them. And parables carry truth, but they don't carry it in the same way that facts carry truth.
I'm wondering what it must be like for you to try to understand what happened historically in the time of Jesus from the vantage point of 1,995 years later. I mean, you know, we keep getting further and further away from the time of Jesus. And yet we're always still trying to understand exactly, you know, as we get further away, we're still trying to understand exactly what happened. So yes. a problematic exercise, really.
It is. I think what has happened for us is that after the Enlightenment, we wanted to know about every story. Yes, but did it really happen? I think people, maybe in general, and maybe people who never have gone through the Enlightenment, can hear a story, get the point, and not actually ask, yes, but did the story actually happen? Somewhat the way you and I may look at a commercial message. We get the point, and we don't really ask whether the megastar, whoever, really wears these shoes or drives this car. We get the point. You should want to drive this car. I think in the first century, people knew when they heard a story that they couldn't really check up on it. If you heard the story about the divine birth, say, of Augustus, and you were for Augustus and you thought he really had saved the Roman Empire and he was a marvelous person, then you believed the story. You didn't really ask yourself, yeah, but I wonder if that actually happened. You heard it, I think, very much like you and I hear a commercial message. So in many of these stories, I don't think that it's a case that they took it all literally and now we're so smart, we know to take it metaphorically. I think they took it very often, got the point, and didn't ask the question, is it literal or metaphorical?
John Dominic Crossan is the author of Who Killed Jesus? He's a professor of biblical studies at DePaul University in Chicago. This is Fresh Air.